Kia ora. I bring you greetings from a very little country, a long, long way away in the South Pacific. I suspect I'm probably the person who's come the furthest for this conference, but Andras, I thank you very much for the honour of being invited to take part, and I very much hope that something of what I say will be of interest to you here today about New Zealand law. We are, as I said, a very small but peaceful, settled country. Civil society is very stable. Our media has been described as not tabloid, well behaved. And so really issues around media law, we have them, but in many ways they're just not comparable to what is happening in countries through Europe. But what I want to do today is just to briefly go through and summarise what my chapter in the book talks about, which is really what John touched upon and described as the tortured process of how Commonwealth countries have tried to develop the Reynolds-type defences, and we've indeed got a defence that developed at pretty much the same time, and we're still struggling now with what the import of that might be and where we might be going. So what I want this defence to do is to turn into a real public interest defence, and that's really what I'm watching now in our case law. And what I'll do in my talk today is just briefly describe how we got to where we are, and then I'll update my chapter in the book because we have had one more case which is of interest since the chapter in the book was published, and that's of particular interest, I think, to this conference because it's a case that involves new media as well as old media and the impact of the defence on that. So the title of my talk is The Burgeoning of Freedom of Expression in New Zealand Defamation Law, because this is an area where indeed freedom of expression is now telling. And as you'll see if you read my chapter, I do discuss how our Bill of Rights Act has impacted on the development of defamation law in New Zealand. And in particular, it was one of the reasons why this defence has been developed. In terms of our law, it's a combination of statute and of the common law. It has to be said, our statute is dated 1992, and it's very difficult for there to be any statutory changes or any impetus for statutory change in New Zealand. This is because our politicians are very protective of defamation law, since it impacts on them significantly on a number of occasions. And so our law was revamped in 1992, hasn't been touched since then, apart from very, very minor amendments. And there is at the moment no priority given to overhauling the law in any way, in particular in the way that has happened in the UK with the Defamation Act in 2013. So while I would say to you that our law of defamation very much mirrors and has mirrored for a long time the English law that we inherited when New Zealand was colonised, I think with the Defamation Act in the UK that perhaps the UK is now departing from us rather than the other way around. And so what I'm describing to you is really probably what English law looked more like before the passing of the Defamation Act. Okay, so in New Zealand, the plaintiff is the person in the strong position, as John has ably demonstrated. The plaintiff only has to show three things: that you've got a defamatory statement, the statement refers to the plaintiff, and the statement has been communicated to a third party. And then the onus will shift onto the defendant to prove a defence of some kind, either one or a basket of defences. In terms of media, we have a form of qualified privilege. The media's privilege is qualified only. And there are numbers of different types of qualified privilege in New Zealand. The first, we have various forms of statutory qualified privilege, two different types there, stronger and weaker. And what I'm interested in today and where our defence, our Reynolds-type defence developed, was within the common law and under this heading of political discussion. We've also had or appear to have a form of branching similar to that has occurred in the UK of neutral reportage, And so the possibilities here from the political discussion defence developing is that we have eventually a defence of true public interest, and that possibly also we have a neutral reportage type of defence as well. So just going back a bit to where our defence came from, common law qualified privilege, and we held to the requirements of the Adam and Ward case that came again from English law, that you could have a defence where there was a privileged occasion. This was where a person was making a communication and they could show they had an interest or a duty, which was legal, social or moral, to make that statement to the person that they were making it to, and that that person had a reciprocal interest in receiving that information. And this, of course, was a defence which was based around that reciprocity. You had to have that reciprocity in the relationship. However, of course, that defence was of very limited use to media, mainly because media publishes too widely, and this means that you can't show that all the parties to whom the information is published have an interest in receiving that information. So what has happened in New Zealand is that a special form of qualified privilege has developed out of the ordinary Adam and Ward common law qualified privilege, and this has been called constitutional privilege. So it's not been called public interest defence, and it was certainly, as you'll see, and I talk about it briefly, was not developed as a public interest defence in a pure form. So this came from a number of decisions, all based around a man called Mr. Longhi, who had been the Prime Minister of New Zealand. And this case went, as it then could in New Zealand, through all our higher courts and into the Privy Council over in the UK, and then back again into New Zealand's Court of Appeal. So the issue of whether we should have this defence or not was fought very long and very hard through all of our courts as far as it could go. And the case involved a publication about Mr. Longhi. This was at the time that he was still a sitting MP in New Zealand, but he was no longer Prime Minister. And this man, Joe Atkinson, who was a writer and also a political science lecturer, wrote an article for a magazine called North and South, which is pretty much a current affairs type magazine in New Zealand. And this article criticised David Longhi's behaviour as Prime Minister and made quite serious criticisms about him lacking focus and getting bored easily and leaving important parliamentary meetings to go for a drive in his car and that sort of thing. So there were quite strong assertions about his performance as New Zealand's Prime Minister. And out of these series of cases, which were only ever fought over this issue of whether this defence existed or not, the case was settled after that point, the New Zealand courts recognised that in New Zealand we have a form of defence which is called constitutional privilege, and this is how it looks. It's available in respect of statements published generally, so that gets over the previous difficulties that you had with so it's 20 minutes on the... Okay. I can't believe a quarter of an hour's gone so quickly. So in respect of statements that are published generally, so this means the media will be able to claim this defence. Our democracy is seen as being of the kind that there's a proper interest that generally published statements concerning the function of government, basically, and the people's representatives are important enough to be subject to this defence. And in particular, it was held a proper interest of this kind exists when you're talking about MPs past, present or future. So that was the basic delineation of the subject matter of this defence. But the other things that were added was that you have to look at what is called a matter of public concern rather than private concern. So you might be talking about Mr. Longhi, but you shouldn't talk about his sex life. And the width of this concern justifies how far the publication may go. And to attract this privilege, the statement has to be published on a qualifying occasion. Now, you'll see, I'm not going to go into all detail since time is moving quite quickly, but in the chapter I do talk about, I've just realised the time runs backwards rather than forwards. Okay, I've got a bit more time than I thought, so I'll slow down. So I'm going to talk about the case law that has occurred since the Longy decisions to show how our judges have tried to develop this defence. And what's happened is that the question has gone into our High Court, which is below the Court of Appeal, which is below the Supreme Court. Now, the High Courts can not bind each other, and so it's really kind of the workroom for the development of New Zealand common law. The judges there will look at these issues, and depending on the case in front of them, the law will be developed. They might go backwards and forwards a bit, they might disagree with each other, and then eventually you'll get a decision from the Court of Appeal or higher that will confirm a position that's been taken. In recent years, we've seen this happen with privacy law in New Zealand. We've had 10 years of decisions in the High Court supporting the development of a right to privacy, and then eventually our Court of Appeal endorsed that, and we now have a tort of invasion of privacy in New Zealand. And so we have a similar process happening here with the development of this constitutional privilege defence in the High Court, although the development, so far as I can see, is more tentative and it's slow and it's flipping backwards and forwards a bit. So our judges are kind of feeling their way. They're not quite so confident with developing this area in relation to this form of defence. And what I want them to do is to move on and make this into the public interest defence that I think it is. And my chapter in the book does in fact say that I think that is what's happening. And so the cases I've used to illustrate this, and I'll talk about a number of them now, certainly seem to be opening the door. We've had this defence develop around the subject matter of MPs, past, present or future. That opens the door. As soon as you do that, then the door can be pushed open further, and I can see our High Court judges are prepared to entertain that. So I'll just talk about a few examples to illustrate better where we might be going. Okay, the first case that occurred after the Longy decision was called Vickery and McLean, and it was actually a Court of Appeal decision. So the law might have been more settled at this level in the Court of Appeal. All that this case decided, however, was that the Longy defence could not apply to elected officials. The Vickery case concerned some council employees and statements that were made about them. And the Court of Appeal said, no, this defence cannot be used in this case by the publication because it doesn't fit that requirement of talking about MPs past, present or future. The other matter of interest that occurred in the Vickery case was the court said that if your allegations are very, very serious ones about criminal matters, then the defence cannot apply then either. Now, I actually disagree with this quite strongly. I think the Longy defence or defence like it should certainly apply to serious criminal allegations if we want to encourage the disclosure of such behaviour, certainly by our elected representatives, and obviously if this is a public interest defence, then perhaps wider than that. That's never been tested, that issue, since Vickery, however, so we don't quite know where that stands. So that's Vickery. The next case of interest is this High Court decision called Osmos. This case involved some statements that were made about a company. So it didn't involve MPs at all, although one of the parties who made one of the statements was in fact an MP, irrelevant in this case though. So the statement made here, or the various publications, were about the quality of a timber product that the Osmos company was producing. The question in the case was largely a procedural one about whether media could be joined as defendants to this action, since they'd published these statements as well. And the judge concluded, without much reasoning, in fact very little, that the media would not be joined as defendants because they would have a public interest defence in relying on the Longy case. So here we have a High Court judge calling this defence a public interest defence, but no discussion as to why this public interest defence would be as seen as acceptable, given that, in fact, of course, it was not in line with precedent from the Longy cases. The judge said that the matter of the timber preservative that was talked about in this case was a matter of public interest in New Zealand. And the reason for that was that New Zealand had a crisis at the time that involved an enormous number of houses that had been built that were leaky buildings. So the issue of whether this preservative product stopped leaky buildings from happening was seen by the judge as very clearly a public interest topic. So we have the judge saying this could be a public interest defence, and in this case it would be available because the topic was one of public interest. Now this, of course, as I said, is not doesn't comply with precedent of the Longy Court, but nonetheless this is the decision in the High Court that's kind of showing the door is open at this point. And next, after the Osmose case, is this case, Peters and TVNZ. I don't really need to talk about the facts of that case. It dragged on for a very long time, and in fact, there are aspects of it still dragging on in New Zealand. But the court made very clear in that case that they did not believe, again, the High Court, they did not believe that they could interpret the Longy decisions as a public interest defence, because that was not what was said in Longy. So the High Court in the Peters case was not prepared to see the Longy defence as a form of public interest defence. Next, we have a case called Smith and Dooley. Now, this is interesting because we've got a bit of flip-flopping between the High Court and the Court of Appeal here. This case involved three elected representatives of a trust, a special trust in the west coast of New Zealand, who had to look after funding of $94 million, who were involved in a dispute between themselves, and one of them, Mr. Smith, brought this claim against two of the... Mr. Dooley brought the claim against two of the others, saying they had defamed him. Now, in the High Court, the judge said that the Longy defence was a public interest defence and that it could be available here. The argument or the nature of the publication could be seen to fit within the requirements of Longy. But then the High Court judge said that the defence was not available because of the behaviour of the publishers. And I'll talk a bit more about that just at the end, the question of responsibilities that John was talking about. So in the High Court, the defence is recognised as a public interest defence, but it fails on the facts. When the matter went to the Court of Appeal, and this again was another chance, we thought the Court of Appeal is going to say that we've got a public interest defence. The Court of Appeal avoided that completely in finding that the original statements were not defamatory to begin with. So unfortunately, the hopes of all commentators and people like me who were waiting to see what would happen with bated breath didn't come into being there. The next case of interest is Carrum and Fairfax, and this is connected to the final case I'll talk about too. This is a case that involved a man called Joe Carrum. He's a very well-known public figure in New Zealand. He was an All Black rugby player, and if you're an All Black rugby player in New Zealand, you are like a saint, and you are very well-known, and everybody knows who you are. You're definitely a public figure. Now, Mr. Carrum supported this man, David Bain, throughout a long period when he was tried and retried of a number of serial murders of his family members. It was a very notorious murder, and Joe Carrum always thought that David Bain was innocent, and David Bain had two trials and has eventually been acquitted in New Zealand. And this is a case that has polarised people in New Zealand because there's a lot of uncertainty about what happened, and David Bain himself has no memory of what happened on this particular day, so we'll never know. But he's recently been acquitted after a second trial in the last 2 years, and of course there are very strong feelings up and down the length of New Zealand about whether he did it or whether he didn't. And this case involved an article that was published in two newspapers in New Zealand that talked about a website and a Facebook page where comments and discussion around the David Bain case were being loaded and commented on. And many, many of these comments were derogatory towards David Bain, and they suggested that David Bain committed this murder, and many, many more were derogatory and defamatory of Joe Karam. So a lot of them were expressions of opinion, a lot of them were expressions of fact, and a lot of them were mixed expressions. So it's a classic case of new media, an opinion type series of publications that are apparently damaging to, in this case, a public figure. Now, Fairfax, the publishing company of these newspapers, was sued by Joe Karam because the two articles in the various newspapers referred to the websites, and one of the articles talked about what was on them and gave the name of the website, and one of them was more neutral and just referred people with a link to the website. So it's a classic first example in New Zealand of the question of linking and who's going to be liable as a linking publisher. Unfortunately, this case was settled, and we don't know what's going to happen to all those points. The newspapers settled it. It was obviously not worth fighting on. Joe Karam is well known as a tenacious person who doesn't give up. Now, I won't mention this case. I do talk about it in the chapter. I want to talk about this case just to finish, as my time's running out. Karam and Parker, which is like a partner case with the previous Karam case I discussed. This involved Joe Karam suing the person who ran the website and who moderated the Facebook page and the website with all the comments on it. And Joe Karam was successful in this action to the sum of over $500,000 against this man who's been bankrupted as a result of his tenacious blogging of very strong opinions and so on that he published. And one of the defences he raised, obviously with the help of some free legal advice, was the Longy defence. And he argued that it could be said here, since he was talking about Joe Karam, who was a public figure, that these statements were subject to this form of qualified privilege. And the court rejected this, and I have some concerns about this decision because of a bias it shows against new media, which I hope doesn't continue in other cases. So what concerns me here is that the judge said this website had been set up by the defendant. It was called Counterspin. It was to provide information to the public about the David Bain case, but the judge said it's really a vehicle to express Mr. Parker's views, so it didn't appear to give rise to a duty to do so. Now, there are two things wrong with this as far as I can see. First of all, it says that in some way new media or expression of views on new media is not the same as old media publication, and it somehow doesn't deserve this defence. And the second thing that raises issues is it returns to the discussion of duty, which used to be used in the Adam and Ward case. And the Longy decisions have moved completely away from that in saying that if the subject matter fits, then you can have this defence subject to the responsibility issue that I'll mention briefly to finish with. So this decision is good because it did, however, suggest that this was a matter of public interest and could be subject to the defence, but the fact that it was on new media meant that it didn't do so. And that, to me, is a matter of regret. I don't think that is the right approach. But nonetheless, it's the latest case in this line of High Court decisions that shows there is still a willingness in our courts to extend this type of defence into a true public interest defence, and I very much hope that will happen in the future. The last thing I'll mention is how you lose this privilege. We have a section in the Defamation Act, Section 19. You lose the privilege as you lose any other form of qualified privilege in New Zealand if you motivated by ill will, or you've taken improper advantage of the opportunity to publish. Now, ill will is when you know that what you're publishing is untrue, and taking advantage is when you're reckless about it or you're cavalier as to the truth. So what I think should have happened in the Karam decision was that the court should have said that the defence was a public interest defence and it was available to Mr. Parker, but he would have lost it because most of his statements would have been found to have been motivated by ill will, or he would have been seen as taking advantage of the opportunity to publish. So that's really where we are in New Zealand at the moment, and I thank you very much for your interest.